Listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM and freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You can hear this show every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This station is commercial-free, collectively run, and has been operating without a license from the U.S. government since 1995. My very special guest on the telephone this evening is Mel Duncan. He is co-founder and former director of Nonviolent Peace Force. He's currently the director of advocacy and outreach, focusing in New York at the United Nations for Nonviolent Peace Force. For more information about this organization, check out nonviolentpeaceforce.org. This group is an amazing experiment and creating a lot of successes already. It's an unarmed, paid civilian peacekeeping force that fosters dialogue among parties in conflict and provides a protective presence for threatened civilians. Their projects have been carried out in places like Sudan, Myanmar, and the Philippines, and involve an extensive range of tactics and strategies that have been quite successful. And I'm very pleased this evening to be able to speak with Mel Duncan, and I want to warmly welcome you, Mel, to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Well, thank you, John, and it's nice to be in Santa Cruz.
Yes, it is. If you would tell start by telling people a little bit about Nonviolent Peace Force. What I'm very excited about and have been for a long time about the organization is the different approaches that are simultaneously enacted with Nonviolent Peace Force, where there's proactive engagement, monitoring of situations, and building of relationships. And these things are quite different. Some of them involve actually intervening in very serious violent war situations, while others involve being tapped into communities to be able to have an early warning response for what's happening. Maybe describe how Nonviolent Peace Force has been effective and grown through the years.
We started organizing Nonviolent Peace Force in 1999, and it officially became an organization at the end of 2002. We came together, and by we I mean people from throughout the world, because we felt that it was time to increase the scale and the scope and the professional nature of unarmed civilian peacekeeping. We all have been involved in a variety of applications of unarmed civilian peacekeeping over the years. For example, I had been in Nicaragua during the Contra War. Other people had worked in Pakistan and India. In fact, Gandhi was working on the Shanti Sena, which is Sanskrit for peace army, when he was killed. And we brought together numerous experiences and decided at the end of 2002, that it was time to really come together and see if this was the place and time in history to advance a large-scale, standing, professional, unarmed civilian peacekeeping corps. What we found in our research and as we've developed this is that there are at least 10 different methods that well-trained civilians can use working with local civilians that will protect civilians who are under direct threat because of war, and also work with local civil society in reducing further violence. And so over the last 11 years, we've been active first in Sri Lanka and then in Guatemala, and we presently have teams, as you mentioned, in the Mindanao region of the Philippines and Myanmar, as well as South Sudan. And let me give you a couple of examples, John, of how this works. The most often used method is one of accompaniment, where a person will accompany another person who is under threat because of the violent conflict. This is often a person who is a human rights defender or a journalist or a peace builder. And we find that if we have someone accompanying that person who's under threat, the likelihood of them living longer and thus be able to continue their work is greatly enhanced. So in Guatemala, in 2007, we were contacted by one of our co-founders who runs a women's human rights defense organization, and that organization's offices had been broken into, the computer stolen, a noose hung from the ceiling, and very graphic messages left on cell phones. This was done because this group was helping to unearth information about the genocide that had gone on in that country since 1954, and in their work, they were starting to implicate political candidates. So this became a very dangerous activity. So we were able to send a team, and for the next 7 months, we merely accompanied these women as they went about the country doing their work. We weren't there to do their work for them. We weren't there to bring an agenda. We were there just to help protect the space so these women could do the very important work and stay alive. So that's one example. Another more recent example took place last April in South Sudan, where there has been a reemergence of a very tragic and bloody civil war that reignited in December of 2013. Last April, two of our civilian protectors, a fellow by the name of Derek from the United Kingdom and Andreas from Mexico, were accompanying 14 women and children who had gotten isolated in a very remote and dangerous area of the bush. So they were accompanying this group and had just happened upon a UN facility when it was attacked by a rebel group. People were being shot point blank in the head. So Derek and Andreas took the 14 women and children into a hut and stood in the doorway. On three occasions, young militiamen with brand new shiny AK-47, and Derek and Andreas in their interview, which can be found on our website, remarked about the shininess of these guns. And I hasten to point out, no AK-47s are manufactured in South Sudan. There are lots of people that get rich off of these wars. So anyway, these young militia said to Derek and Andreas, "You've got to go. We want those people." Very calmly, on three occasions, they held up their Nonviolent Peace Force cards and calmly told the militia, "We are unarmed. We are here to protect civilians, and we will not leave." After the third time, the militia left, and the women and children were spared. Another example of protective accompaniment also comes from South Sudan, where now thousands, up to 100,000 people, have congregated around UN compounds in various parts of the country. These are not refugee camps. They're merely places where people have come together to get some semblance of security. The women in those camps have to leave every day to go and get firewood and water and grind sorghum. Groups of soldiers lurk outside the camp and routinely will gang rape the women as they go to gather the sustenance for their families. And some of these women, John, have told us that the soldiers say to them as they're raping them, "We're doing our job." So what we found is, if one or two of our unarmed civilian protectors, who are always well uniformed, so people know who they are, they come from 25 different countries, that if one or two of them accompany 20 or 30 women, the soldiers look away and leave the women alone. And so what a small investment that we can make to protect people by just having a couple of internationals accompany them from the camp. So those are some examples of accompaniment that we use. I can give you many, many more examples if you would like.
It's so dramatic and inspiring and brings me hope hearing examples like this, because I think people are overwhelmed by war and violence. And also, I suppose, people in the United States largely also have an odd relationship to the violence that's happening around the world, because in a general sense, we are very separate from it, although having a lot of access to imagery and certain details about it. Tell me a little more about some more examples of how accompaniment unarmed civilian protectors are finding success in very stressful, potentially violent situations. And describe, too, you just said that there are unarmed civilian protectors from 25 countries working with nonviolent peace force. How many in all would you say there are around the world? And also, who are these people that come to Nonviolent Peace Force, and what kind of training do they have or do they get? It's a very particular type of situation that they're entering into.
Well, first of all, when you talk about how people watch the news and get overwhelmed by what's going on, and indeed, there's a lot that's overwhelming. There's a lot that can bring us to the brink of despair. Civilians are, in real terms, under greater threat than any time in history. Last summer, the UN High Commission on Refugees said that there are more refugees, more people displaced because of war and persecution than any time since World War II. And Amnesty International pointed out last week in their annual report that 2014 had gotten worse, and that we all have a responsibility to step forward and see that our fellow civilians are protected and that we work with them so they can protect themselves. But the media floods us, and by this I mean the mainstream media, with images of war. And let me give you a quick example. Any of your listeners who still are watching or listening mainstream media will know that in the past week, we have had hundreds of reports of Jihadi John, of this young British citizen who is a part of the Islamic State and has played a gruesome role in the beheadings that ISIL has been doing. But how many times have you heard of another person, another British citizen, Derek, the fellow who stood in the doorway and saved 14 women and children? None. And so that illustrates that we aren't getting the stories of the brave men and women around the world who are making peace, who are building peace, who are protecting civilians. And that's a travesty, because in the end, that merely convinces us for war through creating fear and conditioning that violence is the only response. So I'm so appreciative for you having me on today, because if nothing else, I want to spark our listeners' moral imagination. And when people hear that, you know, we'd like to do something else, but there is no other option, we have to intervene. We have to send in the drones or the cruise missiles or bombs. That's when to engage our imaginations and say, no, there are plenty of alternatives, and that's what we should be supporting and standing for. In terms of the number of people, we currently have 210 people in the field in various parts of the world, and that easily could be 10 times that many if we had the money. And we are growing, we are increasing, but it is painfully slow, because we as a people don't want to invest nearly a 100th of what we want, what we invest in war. I ask people, if you would send to Nonviolent Peace Force 10 cents on the dollar of the percentage that you pay in war taxes this April, that would help us a lot. You know, another success story happened in Mindanao, where we have been for 7 years. Mindanao is the large island in the southern part of the Philippines, where there has been a separatist war that has gone on between the Moro people, the people who have inhabited Mindanao for centuries and did not see themselves as Filipinos. That was a decision that was made by colonial cartographers. And so they have been fighting for independence. We were invited there in 2007 and worked closely with civil society on the ground and maintained relationships with both the armed forces of the Philippines and also the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. So at the end of 2009, there was a ceasefire that was brokered by the Malaysians, and Nonviolent Peace Force was invited to be part of the official ceasefire mechanism, and we were given responsibility for monitoring civilian protection. So for the next 4 years, John, we had teams throughout the island in 9 locations who were monitoring, verifying, and reporting every day on any kind of violation to the ceasefire. And we would monitor, we would report to the government of the Philippines, we would report to the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, and we would report to the Malaysians. More importantly, we trained over 300 volunteers, local people from throughout Mindanao, on the elements of the ceasefire, on how to monitor, how to verify, how to report. And so that spread the reach way beyond any typical monitoring and verification mission might do. And it spread the reach so that people who were living there were actually part of the entire ceasefire. So it also spread ownership, so people believed the part, the process was theirs. That was an important element that led to the signing of a comprehensive peace agreement that was signed a year ago, and now we have a number of people there who are continuing to try to keep things stable during the next year and a half as the peace process is completed and as a semi-autonomous Moro state is instituted. Now, during that time when we were doing the monitoring, there was a time where a patrol from the armed forces of the Philippines and a patrol from the Moro Islamic Liberation Front were converging on a village of about 1,000 people. The people started to panic. They started to pack up. They started to flee. The elders of the village called one of our teams who were living close by. We always lived in areas that experienced the violence. And they said what was happening. So our team said, we'll be there. And en route, they called the commander, the local commander of the Filipino Army, and the local commander of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And in this day and age, you have those guys on speed dial. And they, our people said, you know, there must be a mistake. Your soldiers are converging on this village. It's a violation of the ceasefire. People are panicking. They're starting to flee. You know, we know you don't want that to happen. So to make sure that that doesn't happen, our team will go and stay in the village until your guys back off. Both armed groups that by that time had come within 500 meters of the village backed off, and 1,000 people stayed home. So these are strategies, are methods that work and have been proven to work in some of the most violent places in the world today. Now, we don't just parachute people in with rucksacks full of good intentions. They have to be well-trained, and so people are trained first and foremost in the history of peacekeeping and the history of nonviolence and how those two came together to form Nonviolent Peace Force. Then they learn about the various methodologies and go through strenuous field practice and role play as to how to apply those methods in various situations. They learn how to do conflict analysis and context analysis. They learn how to work as teams, because our teams come from a variety of places, from around the world and different ages, different genders. And they also learn where it is that they need to access personally to gain the strength that they need to do this work. So that's all part of our mission preparedness training. In fact, we're running two of those trainings in South Sudan next month. And so people then come out of that, and after they receive that initial training, they get additional training that is provided by local leaders as to the history of the conflict, the history of the area, the various political and religious and economic dynamics, mapping the conflict and the various actors, and so they are able then to understand the particular context that they're entering. Our people, as I mentioned, come from 25 countries. Their median age right now is 37. Many of these people come with a background in humanitarian delivery or human rights law. They also have a variety of backgrounds. We've had retired judges and teachers and journalists. We look for people who have had extensive cross-cultural experience, and that doesn't mean international experience, because that is often an expression of privilege, but who has crossed cultural boundaries within their own community, who has worked in teams where they've had to make quick decisions that have very heavy consequences. We also look for people who have demonstrated resilience. We don't need somebody who's 100% successful, whatever that means, they mean. We're much more interested in finding out what people did the day after they failed and how they picked themselves up. Because in the field, our people are going to see and experience some very rough things, and they need to be able to report the next day. So those are the kinds of people that we look for. We always let people know of jobs available on our website, and if they're chosen, they'll be well-trained and supported and be able to be part of an emerging new way to deal with transforming violent conflict.
My name is John Malkin, and this is The Great Leap Forward. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. This evening, I'm speaking with Mel Duncan, who is co-founder and former director of Nonviolent Peace Force. He is currently the director of advocacy and outreach. I am curious to hear your ideas and thoughts about the potential for bringing the strategies and successes of Nonviolent Peace Force to the neighborhoods of the United States of America, where periodically and currently, there's a lot of attention and discussion about the militarization of police, police getting more and more equipment, training, vehicles from the military, and there being quite a few killings of unarmed, especially poor and black men, including Michael Brown and Eric Garner, and a falling away of trust, definitely between civilians and police. What are your ideas about the potential for accompaniment, nonviolent intervention, proactive presence, all of these tactics being used in America with policing?
They can be used, and in fact, they are being used. As you point out, the United States government has provided $5 billion worth of military equipment to police forces around the country. So I come from Minnesota, and the small towns in Minnesota have, for example, grenade launchers and armored personnel carriers. Well, they don't need that kind of equipment. They need to build relationships in the community. And that's what our kind of protection is based upon. It's not based upon threat and dominance. It's based upon building relationships. That policing at its best is building relationships and trust with the community. There are a number of groups around the world, in addition to Nonviolent Peace Force, that are employing various types of unarmed civilian peacekeeping. One of those groups is a domestic group in the United States known as Cure Violence. Cure Violence used to be called Ceasefire. In fact, there was a Academy Award nominated documentary that was done on them 4 years ago about the gang intervention work that they do in Chicago. They approach violence as a public health problem. And so they use epidemiological approaches to stop the spread of violence. So, for example, one of the methods that they use is when there is a gang-related killing, usually of a young man, they have what they call interrupters. And these are people, many of whom have been in gangs themselves, some of whom were recruited right out of prison to become part of Cure Violence. And they learn how to do violence interruption. So they will go to the gang of the young man who's been killed and also to the family and work with them to not do retaliatory violence. So to stop the spread. And they have been very successful in a variety of neighborhoods, not only in Chicago, but in Baltimore and New York. And so if you go on their website, Cure Violence, you will see they are the most quantitatively analyzed of any of the groups doing this kind of work. And so there are those methods that are already there, that are being done, and that can be applied not only by Cure Violence or Nonviolent Peace Force, but by community groups. And we certainly could work with those groups in providing some support and training as to how to deal with what is an epidemic of violence, and tragically where, as we saw in Los Angeles again a couple of days ago, where people need to be protected from certain members of the police force. And this comes from an attitude of militarized domination, of us versus them. And that seems to be a prevailing attitude on the part of some police. And when that happens, you have the tragedy of the killing, often of young black men, that needs to be stopped. And there are methods where communities can protect themselves and also learn how to do relationship building with police even when police want to try to dominate.
Mel, I'd love to continue on this topic just for a few more minutes. I have been writing a series of articles about the police in Santa Cruz because they have received a number of grants, like many police departments across the country, grants from the Department of Homeland Security for surveillance equipment, military-style weaponry, and vehicles. The Santa Cruz police received a $251,000 grant from Department of Homeland Security late last year for a armored personnel carrier called a Bearcat. There's been a huge discussion since then in the Santa Cruz community. There's a lot of opposition to this vehicle coming here. A Bearcat was sent to Berkeley. Activists there actually opposed it and had it returned. There are even more intense vehicles, mine-resistant, ambush-protected MRAP vehicles that have gone to places like Davis and a city near Monterey called Delray Oaks has one of those too. So they're all over the place. It definitely resonates for me that there is a growing perspective among police of us versus them. I mean, we are actually in what police and military and the Department of Homeland Security call a war. It's a war on terrorism. And yet, setting that aside, I mean, there's when I talk to police locally, I don't get a sense that they share that perspective, that there is an us versus them mentality. Setting that aside, what I do hear is that they are asked to arrive at situations that have reached a point of seriousness where there is violence happening, and they have very few options available to them. And they, you know, they argue that they're using the tools that are necessary in that moment and that there aren't other tools available. My sense is that they will surely use the tools that they have been trained to use, and they will not use tools that they're not familiar with. So, like you're saying, they, of course, use domination tools to either threaten to use force or use force. What would you say to police officers who are, because of your experience, Mel, in places where there are people with guns and they're shooting at other people and intervention happens, what would you say to police who are arguing, hey, we're going into the most extreme situations and we're simply using the tools that are appropriate?
I first would say how much I respect and appreciate their service, and also the community is their partner. People in communities want to live in safe areas, and so it's a matter of figuring out how to build relationships where we all take responsibility for our security. And so, for example, in the case that you mentioned about where things have built up to the point where police have to intervene with heavy weaponry and great force, there could be systems that are established that we have worked on, for example, in South Sudan, where we have worked with communities to set up early warning, early response systems. People know when trouble's brewing. Sometimes they don't have it all systematized and listed out, but they can see, well, this is happening, and these people have shown up, and this is happening down on the corner. And so what we do is work with communities to help them to put together a system where they could look at the different criteria and then to establish that, yes, indeed, this is an early warning situation. Trouble is in the works. And so then, what do you do? This is just to nip it in the bud. We often will have mixed teams because we've done training across racial or ethnic or religious or political divides. And so mixed groups of people then will go to the violence point and will quash it before it explodes. So let me give you an example. This is going back to South Sudan, and we worked with communities in Lake State to establish an early warning, early response system. And so late one afternoon, fighting had broken out. The community early warning system had worked. They had identified that two clans had broken out and into a violent conflict with machetes and guns. And so a team of local people from the area, intertribal team, accompanied by some of our international civilian protectors, went to the point where the violence had broken out. Now, it happened that in this team was a man named Abraham. And Abraham is from the Dinka tribe in South Sudan. And so he's very tall. He's about 6 foot five. Another member of the team was a woman by the name of Asha. Asha is from India. She's a human rights attorney. And she's 5 foot tall. So here were Abraham, 6'5", and Asha, 5 foot, coming together upon these young warriors who had started to fight one another. When they got there, one of the young warriors turned to Abraham and said, "Who's the small girl?" And Abraham said, "Why, that's Asha Ashokan." And if you know Indian history, Ashoka is a very prominent nonviolent leader, king. A little over 2,000 years ago. And this young warrior said, "Well, where's she from?" And Abraham said, "She's from India." "Well, why is that small girl here?" And Abraham said, "She's here to get you to quit fighting." And this young fighter turned to Abraham and said, "You know, if someone's going to care that much to come that far, we'll stop." And he called his men off, and they backed away, and the fighting stopped. Now, that's a moment. That's not sustainable peace building. But in times of violent conflict, moments mean everything. That gave us a chance to bring the rival chiefs together, to just sit with them, to provide them the space. They talked through the night. They worked out a resolution. And these groups did not go back to fighting. So there could be applications in Santa Cruz and other areas where people in the community develop an early warning system and then develop early response teams where they take it upon themselves to intervene, sometimes with police, sometimes without police, but to create a partnership, so that we truly are living the oneness as opposed to the us then. And unfortunately, we've found ourselves thrust into an era of not only a war on terrorism, but an era of perpetual war. And John, I spend a lot of time speaking to young people these days. And so I start out, when I talk with them, I start them out in an exercise called the human barometer, where on one wall, people strongly agree with a statement, on the other wall, they strongly disagree. And then on PowerPoint, I'll flash up a statement, and people place themselves along the continuum, and to strongly agree, to strongly disagree. Well, one of the statements that I've been using lately is, "My country will be at war for the rest of my life." And John, it is tragic. The younger the group that I deal with, the more people agree with that statement. Now, they don't like it. They're not supporting it. But that's the way they see their reality, that our country will be at war for the rest of their lives. And that's something that we have to stop. And as long as we have that mentality, that subliminal view that we're constantly at war, then that metaphor will translate into all of our relationships and will permeate not only our police forces in our communities, but in our schools and bullying and in our families with domestic abuse. It gives that license. And so we have to reverse that and show that we can intervene and deal with many violent conflicts by intervening nonviolently and by building relationships, by getting rid of the dualistic way that violence promotes of us versus them, and realize it's just us.
Mel, I often reflect on the fact that my whole life, and I'm 51 years old, my whole life, the United States has pretty much been at war. And you're right, we are in a somewhat of a permanent warfare position right now. And I have a 7.5-year-old son, and sometimes I'm quite delighted to see injected into books for kids that he's reading or films for kids that we go to kind of the notion of save the planet, whether that be regarding the climate or relationships between people. But I have to say, lately, I'm finding that message disturbing me, that there are people being born into a world where they're being told, you need to do something to ensure the survival of this place. That is a relatively new phenomenon on planet Earth. And I'm grappling with that, having a little person who's going to be alive, hopefully much longer than me. I wonder if you would say a little more about the roots and underlying sensibility that you bring to Nonviolent Peace Force, in philosophical terms or spiritual terms. You were mentioning Gandhi and Shanti Sena, his idea of a Nonviolent Peace Force that you and Nonviolent Peace Force are actually implementing, and it seems a direct implementation of Gandhi's constructive, his nonviolence program that was made up of, he always emphasized the constructive part of it, but also said there needed to be an obstructive part to the nonviolence program. So just to hear a little more about your own journey through this.
Well, I've always been an organizer since the time I was 14, 15 years old, working on peace and civil rights and the environment. And in the late 90s, I had an opportunity to leave my work as an organizer and to spend a year and a half studying and reflecting on the connections between peace, justice, the environment, and spirituality. And that led me to a number of places, including a place just north of you in Oakland, to a school called the University of Creation Spirituality. And, excuse me, that was right on the edge of downtown Oakland. And it was in that school where one day I was confronted by a Sufi who was teaching a class on Rumi. And she confronted me that it was time for me to enter the heart of my enemy. And when I started to do that, I started to see the dualistic way that I had organized. It had always been us versus them, right versus wrong, good versus evil, 50% plus one meant that we kicked their butt. And I was being challenged at that point, John, down to my very core, to shed this illusion or delusion of duality and start organizing from a place of unity. And so when the student's ready, the teachers appear. So for the rest of my time in Oakland at the University of Christian Spirituality, I started looking at the approaches of unity. That led me to a Vietnamese monk by the name of Thich Nhat Hanh. And at the end of my fellowship, I was sitting in Plum Village in southern France with Thich Nhat Hanh. And he was saying, at that time, and that was 1998, that we are no longer at a place in history where we can afford to take sides, that the stakes are just too high, and that we have to shed this dualism. And so I was at this Buddhist monastery, and upon leaving there, I was riding on a bus through southern France, and I wrote in my notebook a reflection piece on a nonviolent peace corps. And so my vision really came as a result of this process of shedding that dualistic way that we see the world of us versus them, right versus wrong, and realizing that we all are unified. We all have so much in common. We all have 7.5-year-old children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews or neighbors. And I think that you're right. It's up to all of us to work on that survival of our being, of our planet. Earlier tonight, I was at a little house party and concert at Peter Yarrow's house. Peter, I'm sure most of the people listening know, is the Peter of Peter, Paul, and Mary. He was the fellow who wrote Puff the Magic Dragon. He's 75. He still does 50 fundraising concerts a year, all on respect, on peace, on unity. And he and his daughter Bethany tonight sang a song about the survivors and about no matter what our age is, we have something to contribute. And I believe, John, that if we are truly true to who we are meant to be, and if we find the courage to follow that, whatever that is, and each of us has, as Gandhi talked about, that still small voice within us, and that if we take the time and take the courage to follow that still small voice, as a people, as a species, as a planet, we'll be okay. But it's going to take everything that we have.
I think it's a common notion that among activists, especially, that it's not people, civilians, who have so much difficulty getting along. It's governments. And I don't know if this is exactly true, but what I'm curious to hear about from you is the relationship that you have with governments. You're working in a lot of different locations, Syria and Lebanon, Sudan, Myanmar, and soon in Ukraine. You pointed out, which is true and astonishing, that the amount of money that goes into war making and research and development of new technologies to kill and blow up things better is just astonishing, and that people at the bottom line, as wars begin and wars end, there's a sort of a constant thing that's happening, and that is that there's a lot of people making a lot of money, from war, and a lot of those are governments. What is your relationship and Nonviolent Peace Force relationship to governments? And I guess I want to add one other thing too. I guess I've, in my idealism, I've imagined, it sounds so simplistic, but I've always imagined there would be less shooting of people if people had less guns. And that, I mean, it sounds so simple, but again, as you were talking about, people make a lot of money off of selling guns, so they are ubiquitous now. So just tell me your thoughts about this.
Well, first of all, we are civil society to civil society. Nonviolent Peace Force is a civil society organization. We work with local grassroots groups who invite us. We engage in providing them with protection. And what we find is they mutually provide us with protection. And that there's a presence that emerges, a presence when people come together and share their struggle in solidarity with no extraordinary means, no weapons, but just each other. And that is extremely powerful. We saw it portrayed in the movie Selma again. And if people haven't had a chance to see that, I recommend that they get out and see it. Now, governments ultimately are based upon threat of violence. And so it's a very different formulation. Now, we work with governments. We have to get visas to get our people into countries. Sometimes that's tricky. Sometimes we're welcomed. Sometimes some of our people get kicked out. But we don't go in to necessarily antagonize a government. We are nonpartisan. We are there to protect civilians and deter violence. So we work with governments, and we work with rebel armed actors. It's our business to create relationships with all of them. And as I illustrated in the Philippines, that worked out well when we were invited by both the armed forces of the Philippines and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. Neither of them were pacifists, but they called upon this nonviolent group to be a part of the ceasefire mechanism. And so we, at times, will receive funding from governments that are not involved in the conflict. For example, we've received financial support from Belgium, from Norway, from Germany, from the United Kingdom, from Australia. And we also work, much of my time I spend at the United Nations, which in the end is a club of states. They are 193 governments that are represented. And so we do have governments, and we need to engage them. We need to demonstrate, as Gandhi pointed out, and you mentioned earlier, through constructive programming, that there are alternatives to violence and threat, force of threat, or threat of force, and that relationships and security can also come through the building of relationships.
Mel, it's really...
And governments, you know, governments haven't been around that, and the nation state has only been around for a few centuries. And so hopefully we'll move beyond that sometime in the near future.
I hope so, too. And I'm glad that you... I view governments in the concise way that you described. They are based on the threat of violence. I think Tolstoy, who communicated quite a bit with Gandhi,
yes.
As I'm sure
Letter
you know.
Letter to a Hindu. Have you ever read that?
Which one?
Letter to a Hindu.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, Tolstoy he had this sentence in one of his essays, government is violence, which has always stuck with me. I'm really grateful that we have had a chance to talk, Mel. I wonder if you, lastly, if you would just give us a recent experience you've had, just to give us another idea of what you're doing with Nonviolent Peace Force. I know that you have recently been to Lebanon. A year ago, you were in Syria, and you are speaking at the United Nations regularly. What's a recent experience that has stood out for you?
We recently received a grant from the European Union to start a civilian protection program in Syria. So as you mentioned, I was in Lebanon meeting with our partners, and Cure Violence, by the way, the gang interruption program, is a partner with us, as well as working with two Syrian organizations, including the Syrian Civil Coalition, which is a coalition of 60 grassroots groups working inside of Syria. Some of them oppose the government, some are neutral, and some support the government. And we'll be working with them as they put together violence reduction and civilian protection programs in very localized areas, in 15 to 20 areas around the country. And as they do that, start to build a relationship among themselves across political and religious and geographic lines so that they can strengthen a foundation for a future Syria. So, an example, it was 3 weeks ago Saturday night, I was sitting in Beirut with three young women, not one of them was over 35, John. And these are all women who have worked on peace building and reconciliation work inside of Syria. And they gushed. They were telling me about their experiences, telling me about the peace building exercises they were doing in places like Aleppo and Homs, and bringing people together. And just through their very spirit, saying they refuse to be victims. They refuse to be pushed under by fear. They were going to continue their work. And as I sat there, I thought, the world is in good hands. And then a little later, I thought, you know, no matter what happens, these are the people that I want to stand beside. And I'm sure if your listeners would have gotten to spend that evening, they would want to stand beside those young women as well. And those are the future. Those are the women who are creating the future right now. And that can be a future that goes beyond perpetual war and institutes a culture of peace.
I really envision Nonviolent Peace Force and other groups like it really moving and continuing and evolving and shifting consciousness and energy and funding into nonviolence to the point where police and military simply fall away because they're not being called upon for their so-called services anymore. I'm grateful for the work that you've done, and David Herzo and many, many others, people you mentioned who are in the field all over the world with Nonviolent Peace Force. And I'm deeply grateful to have this time with you this evening, Mel Duncan. Mel Duncan is the co-founder and former director of Nonviolent Peace Force. He's currently the director of advocacy and outreach. Mel, like I said, I'm really grateful to have had this time with you. Thank you very, very much.
Well, John, I appreciated it as well. And keep up your work and talking with people and sharing alternatives that are effective, that aren't pipe dreams, but represent hard-nosed hope.
Thank you, Mel. Thank you very much, and I hope you have a fine evening this evening.
Thank you. Good day.
This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin. This is The Great Leap Forward.